city coming back after that earth, the devastation of the earthquake.
Mm-hmm. What was her name, sorry?
Her name is Karen Gadbois.
Uh-huh.
And she, her father was a, he worked with a lather that worked with plaster in Boston. He was the last surviving member of the union, in the Lathers Union in Boston. And so she's got this historic preservation ethic. And she was very concerned about the way houses were being torn down when they needn't be torn down. I mean, these houses here, that were the old ones that were built with plaster, the old plaster houses could survive a saltwater flood. The water comes up, goes down, the plaster's fine, the wood's fine, and it didn't faze them that much. Sheetrock, you have to change. And
in a way, some of the old construction methods, the wood and it's kind of better equipped for this.
Mm-hmm. Yep, the water would run right out.
Yeah,
it'd be fine.
Yeah,
and so but the heavy-handed government now, which it's flooded, let's tear it down. And so she was really concerned about that. And then she was really delighted when the state came up with a couple million dollars. It wasn't a lot of money, but a couple million dollars to provide assistance to people that needed it to have their houses gutted to preserve the wooden structure. Like if they had sheetrock, they needed the houses gutted. And so she was really tickled when that money was made available and the program started up. But she's also kind of skeptical, so she went out and started checking on some of these houses that had been renovated according to all the records. Or gutted, not renovated, but gutted. And discovered that some of them had been gutted by religious organizations, and then somebody charged for gutting them on top of that.
Mm-hmm.
She found some that had been gutted and then torn down within a week or two after they were gutted, officially gutted, and found all these discrepancies. And she'd started a little blog. She'd never blogged before, but after Katrina, she started this little blog. And so she started reporting on this stuff. And then she met and was covered by our CBS affiliate, WWL. Lee Zurich, this reporter, covered her. And then the Times-Picayune picked it up, and then the New York Times picked it up, and she had a half-page picture of me on the New York Times, and labeled Gadfly Gadbois. So we were really proud of Karen. So next thing you know, this Jackie that I mentioned, the city council president, has Ray Nagin in front of the city council saying, what are you going to fix this program? And he says, well, I'm going to investigate. And she says, you don't need to investigate. We are investigating, and the federal government's already investigating. What are you going to do to fix this program? And so it's been there's some really good street-level reporting by a citizen activist that was a blogger.
Yeah.
And long story short, Karen and a couple of friends have recently announced that they're starting The Lens, which is a new blog, industrial strength, with funding from George Soros,
mm-hmm.
and an affiliation with, which incredibly, Fox News.
Okay.
But Lee Zurich, this reporter from CBS, has moved over to Fox, and so they're going to be working in conjunction with Fox News doing in-depth investigative reporting. And so it's really creative and innovative.
Mm.
And I, like, again, I had, one night we had Karen over for dinner. Bev and Laura and I had dinner together. I'm sitting there with these three heroes, and I'm going, Dale, am I lucky or what?
Sure. Yeah. So the thing that interests me is, who looks after all these people who look after everybody? There's a lot of people giving a lot. Where do they get their sustenance from? Who looks after them?
I think we kind of have try to look out after each other, I think. There's nobody coming down here to help us too much.
Sure.
One of the organizations my wife was the chair of is the Institute for Mental Hygiene, which bad name, but it's an old organization which looks at the mental health of kids.
Okay.
And she can tell you more about what's being done about children's mental health issues. You know, those, all those issues. But you know, the need for social workers in schools is tremendous. But you can't just get them to volunteer. You got to pay them if they come in and work in your school. Yeah, so where's the money going to come from? And so there are tremendous unmet needs like that. You know, I've seen statistics that the suicide rate has tripled in the city since the storm, and it's still bad. The spring of 2006, one of my wife's partners, whose brother had died a couple of years before, and so he was kind of looking after his sister-in-law and her family and his family, and they both lost their houses in the flood, and he was trying to help them rebuild and everything. And in spring of 2006, he hung himself. They took him out for a drive, and they found him hanging in his gutted house. And you know, lawyers and another friend of ours, neighbor friend of ours, who was one of the top coastal restoration scientists, was found dead in his apartment at 54, the year before last. You know, it's personal. You know, it's not just poor people. It's kind of radicalized me a little bit. I'm kind of furious about it that we haven't had more understanding. And then you read, you know, the media and all these right wing assholes in their pompous, you know, putting us down for even living here in the first place. You want to go choke somebody. So, yeah, mental health is an issue. And I'll tell you. Scotch helps a lot, you know, okay. Smoking. You know, we're smokers are, you know, we're in force, you know. It's a struggle. But I'm fascinated about you guys and your community collaboration efforts, because I think that's why I wanted, you know, to share some of the, you know, because we're getting some of that. We have some potential that developed, particularly after the storm, and I guess now I'm at full disclosure. I think I'm getting concerned now, because a lot of the resources that we had immediately are sort of drying up, and I think the competitive.
It's
coming back real fast, okay. And I think we're losing some of that.
Okay.
So any thoughts y'all have about sustaining it, I'd really appreciate it.
Well, yeah, the stuff we do kind of pales into.
Yeah.
I mean, we're just playing. You know, I really. It feels completely purposeless and pointless. Put in the context of people with real need. I don't know. What have we learned, Brian? We've learned, I suppose, that if you just get smart people together and don't tell them what to do, but let them talk about the issue and work out what to do for themselves, then they will come up with amazing things. And so the trick is always to keep pulling back from directing things, even though it's extremely tempting to point people in the right direction. But I don't know whether that's I don't know how transferable that is. Because, you know, like I say, it seems just silly in comparison.
Well, I don't think so at all.
I think we've got to try and get through the emotional part of it, which is very hard to see. To drive around and see this now, 5 years on, is very hard, and it does make what we're trying to do in London look a bit trivial in comparison. But maybe we should just try and push through that and say, well, look, you know, there might be some things I'm learning a lot just hearing you speak, and it's given me a lot to think about. But there may be some things that, you know, even if they are trivial, relatively, that we've done that will be helpful.
Sure.
the getting smart people together, I think, you know, that's a friend of mine is a knowledge management guru.
Mm-hmm.
Or was he? Last year when we went to South by, he had moved over to San Antonio, Texas, which is near Boston,
yes. Mm-hmm.
And was involved in starting a nonprofit there, focusing on providing providing IT solutions to people with disabilities and using helping empower them. Mm-hmm. And but he still came back here a lot and worked with his family and stuff. Mm-hmm. And so I went to the booth that they had at South by last year and asked about him, hoping he'd be there. And his funeral was the day before, which I didn't know. He was 53.
Oh.
Same year as my other friends.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
But Bill and I were talking back in the spring, 2 years ago, about building community with social media.
Yes.
And, you know, I had read that, you know, when you start a community, like MySpace started with 50 people, and they defined it, and it stayed that way. And, and you know, we talked about getting a bunch of smart people together, and that's basically what I've been trying to do. That's the way you start, right?
I think one of the things I've learned is that you need to have a plan, but the plan is more reporting on the governance structure of what you're doing and making sure the people who are funding what you're doing are happy with the direction and can see what you're doing. And actually, that plan is not what's going to happen. It has to be more fluid than that. Otherwise, you won't get the people that you want, because the kind of people you want are going to look at a Gantt chart with milestones and all that kind of nonsense on it, and they're going to think, well, I don't really want to, you know, I don't want to be constrained by that, mm-hmm. by that box, mm-hmm. or by that thinking.
Mm-hmm.
But actually,
but in order to get funding, you got
to. But in order to persuade people that actually you do know what you're doing, and you can manage a project which is as fluid as the one we're trying to manage, you have to be able to kind of reassure people who need the structure that there is, you know, there is an objective and there is structure, and you're being careful about that thinking, even though you may not necessarily need or want to impose that on the people that you're working with. And that's the job that we've been doing, which is a very delicate balancing act.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
And we're going through it now with this space in central London where we're trying to do creative collaboration, which lots of people are asking questions about, you know, what's your plan for X, or what's your policy on Y, or how are you going to deal with Z? You know, what we say is, well, we don't know. You know, how do you think we should deal with it? How would you tackle it? And so what we're trying to do is not go into expert mode, if you see what I mean, the way that consultants tend to go into expert mode.
Believe me.
To try and stay away from the expert mode of operation. And and that's very hard to do.
Well, I saw with one of your posts you talked about action research. I'm a big fan. It's like, you know, everybody talks about what are best practices. And in fact, nobody ever went through this before. We got to make it up.
Yeah, exactly. Well, that's where we are. Yeah, I mean, action research. You see, the thing about action, if you look at the literature on action research, it's a fantastic idea, and I think it's time it was modernized in the way in which it can deal with some of the big problems we're trying to tackle now. Of whatever scale, and I think it's a very powerful and interestingly, one of the people in one of the funding bodies that we're working with, the Higher Education Council Fund, which Higher Education Council
funding
Higher Education
Council
Funding
for
Council for England,
Hefke,
she was very positive about our suggestion that we do this by using the principles of action research, that we try some things with the full knowledge that actually they may not work, or
that you learn from it and then you start over again.
The thing to do is to try and find out what the best, what is the best cycle time and scale for those kind of experiments before you say, hang on a minute, we need to iterate, let's sit and think about this for a bit, and then let's try and think through what we might do differently, or what we've learned from what we've done that then enables us to do the next thing.
Mm-hmm.
And the other thing I'm really thinking hard about is what does our business is called Complexity Partners, because we're interested in organizational complexity. What does emergence mean for projects of of this type? How do you encourage emergent behaviour so that you start to get the community to build itself around the structures they need in order to do whatever it is they want to do?
Mm-hmm.
And it's
this is Karen Gadwah. We were having conversations early on about if there are best practices, maybe we should be looking at what Mexico City did, because they didn't have effective government. And they had this, of course, the earthquake only affected a small part of Mexico City. It wasn't 80% of the whole city like this, like we had. But what does a population with no effective government do in a situation like this, and how do you recover? And so, the emergency behavior, it kind of brings that up for me, because it's like, what is happening here? And I guess that's where some of your questions were. It's like, how are we responding? And it's really hard. I hate to generalize too much, because I can only talk about my personal experience and the people I've been working with, and there are a lot of people that are still just totally floundering and doing nothing.
Of course. I think the other thing that I forget that we've learned, and that isn't necessarily widely understood, is that the way that relationships can get built through complementary online and offline activities. So the phenomenon that we've observed before of in our personal lives of meeting people face to face, then meeting them online, and the relationship gets built in layers as you mm-hmm. go back on you. It's mm-hmm. more functional, it's more effective. You can do more stuff together. And what we've done, what's happened with the Tuttle Club, is that we've started to see how that works in a large group of people who get together and meet regularly. And what happens is people start to do stuff spontaneously. They start to collaborate, they start to build things. That's why Brian and I are here on this trip today, because we're part of this thing, interesting conversations.
And that's what I mean about this concept of cycle time. I mean, I think one of the reasons why the Tuttle Club has been so successful in London is that it always happens on a Friday. It's always 10 till 12, and it's always a weekly cycle, which means that if you miss a couple of meetings, and some people only come to one a month, but there's always one to come to every month, if you see what I mean, for them.
Every week.
Because it's every week.
Uh-huh.
And we're trying to have it in a place where it can happen in that place for an extended period, so that it becomes something that people can plan around. They'll come and they'll have a breakfast meeting in London if they're not based in London.
What's come. The cross street? We're on.
That's okay. We need to
figure out where we're going here.
Yeah.
Go to.
I noticed one of you is connected or knows David Gertine.
I've
met him on LinkedIn 2 years ago.
And okay.
Kind of followed his stuff a little bit. His knowledge cafes seem like they'd be pretty interesting.
They're very interesting. They inspired me a lot. Yeah. The street, the address is 1208 North Gayoso, Gayoso.
Okay, I don't know where Gayoso is here. Let's see here what we can do. This is not. This is vastly inferior to my
this
wife's.
This is Esplanade,
affinity.
Is it?
Yes, we're on Esplanade Avenue.
Okay.
So I've got to go more detail here. Okay, so that's why I should have had a map. Yeah. I haven't figured this thing out yet, so. Let me call Taylor and see what kind of directions he can give us. Why don't I do that?
That is fair. I'm going to shut that off.
Oh, yeah.